that says life.
Good evening, everyone. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay in Fife, and as ever, I'm joined tonight by John Johnson over in Glasgow, and by Laura Steckley of the Glasgow School of Social Work. Good evening, John. Good evening, Laura. How are you both this evening?
Hello.
Busy. Good. Yeah. Laura.
Yep, I'm good. Thanks. Yes.
Fantastic.
Hello.
Hi. And it's great you can be our guest tonight, Laura. I'm certainly as somebody who's worked in residential childcare and education for the last 10 years. Really looking forward to hearing about your research and your work and everything that you're going to speak to us about tonight around touch between adult and children in education and human services. We're looking at it from various angles this evening. We've got 45 minutes and no doubt there'll be colleagues and people we know and people we don't know who will be listening in to the live stream at edutalk.cc, and it may be that some of the listeners wish to get in touch between now and around about 8:45. If any listeners would like to come in with any comments or questions at any time for John and I, but of course tonight for our guest Laura Steckley, then you can email, that's at edutalker, edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, you can put your comment or question for Laura on there, and if you just include the hashtag EduTalk, I'm delighted we've actually got we've got several questions already, which we'll put to Laura during the show. I think we're going to start with, I'll ask Laura in a moment to introduce herself and then introduce the topic for tonight around touch between adults and children. If you're listening to the recording, you can of course leave comments at any point. You can go to edutalk.cc and click on comment, leave a comment there, or you can get in touch with us by email or on Twitter at any time between now and the next show. And just finally, if you're listening to Radio Edutalk for the first time, there's really kind of two strands to the project. There's edutalk.cc, which is a website to which any adult who's involved in education or care or working with children can post audio. So that could be a recording of yourself speaking at a conference, it could be a recording of you and colleagues talking at a round table, or it could just be you, speaking into your phone, your thoughts on something. And there's various different ways to send audio to edutalk.cc, and if you just go to the website, you'll find out more about that there. And every Wednesday, usually Wednesday evening, we have our live show, and if you go to edutalk.cc and click on Radio Edutalk, you'll be able to find out all the different speakers and guests and panel discussions, etc., and topics and themes between now and the summer. We're chock-a-block, and then we're even starting to plan our shows towards the second half of the year. So sorry about a kind of fairly lengthy introduction, but I'm aware that people are coming to Radio Edutalk every week. Laura, could I just ask you to introduce yourself, your career to date, where you're working just now, the kind of context that you're working in, and then if you wish, just go straight into introducing the topic of tonight's show. Thanks.
Okay. I work for the Glasgow School of Social Work, but I'm also owned by CELSIS, which is the new name for what used to be CERC. And CELSIS stands for the Centre of Excellence for Looked After Children in Scotland. And before working for CELSIS and GSSW at the University of Strathclyde, I also worked in residential childcare. And prior to that, I worked in residential treatment for adolescents in the United States. Very similar and at the same time different. So let's see, I teach and do research and do some consultancy, all pretty much in the area of residential child care, some in the area of ethics as well. That's another interest of mine, and I am an undergraduate degree in that. And I did a very large piece of research on physical restraint in residential child care and went across 20 different residential establishments across Scotland, listening to children, young people and staff talk about their views and experiences about physical restraint. And in listening to people, and I've published quite a lot because it was a huge amount of data, I started to think about the relationship between touch and some of what they were talking about. And so the most recent publication from that research is about touch. And I did some research on touch generally, and then I went back to the data, to these interview transcripts, and really started analyzing quite in depth what people were saying about touch. And so for the sake of a 45-minute discussion that I'd really like to be discursive with questions and comments and that sort of thing, I'm going to try to keep it to just 10 or 15 minutes and then open it up for hopefully just under a half an hour of discussion. And so I guess I'll start with talking about touch a bit, and then I'm going to talk about some of the complexities around touch and maybe very briefly touch on then kind of what I found in my own research on physical restraint, and then we can go from there in terms of what people are interested in. So to start with, just in talking about touch, probably if this is an area of interest to the listener, there's a fantastic research center on touch in Florida, and they have a wonderful website that can be accessed from anywhere in the world called the Touch Institute. So if you were to use a search engine and just look for the Touch Institute, it was founded by Tiffany Field, and they have done numerous studies on touch, and it's a wealth of information. Tiffany Field also has a book called Touch, and I think that's a good starting point. And I'm just going to touch on a few bits of information about touch generally. Well, touch is the first of our five senses to develop, and it's the first communication that we learn as infants when we come into this world. And it is, research is becoming completely unequivocal as to developmental importance of touch in the developing child, as well as ameliorative in terms of how touch can reduce the impacts of things like trauma and deprivation and help healing processes. We know that there's links between touch and the development of the hippocampus in the brain, and we know that touch can decrease levels of cortisol being a stress hormone. And so in a lot of studies looking at the impact of touch, not only in self-report do people say they have less stress, but also there's more tangible evidence in terms of lower levels of cortisol. For educators that may be listening, I was looking around again at some research, and for instance, they did a study in classrooms, and even momentary touches were found to have positive impact. In one study, students who received supportive touch either on their back or their arm, as teachers were passing by, that sort of thing, were nearly twice as likely to volunteer in class as compared to those who did not. And we know that touch, it used to be thought that touch just enhanced communication, but actually it's being seen as one of our richest means of emotional communication, and often emotions and expressions can be communicated more quickly and more accurately through touch than through words. Now, from my background, thinking about kids who have had abusive experiences of adults or adults that have neglected them, talk is pretty cheap in working with these kids, and often touch can actually communicate in a way that's more acceptable and more persuasive in terms of our care for them than just the words, "I care about you." Not that I would ever suggest that we shouldn't verbally let kids know that, too. So there's lots of good stuff about touch, and I'm very excited about this subject, so I'm going to try to limit it just to that, but there's other very interesting studies that we could end up talking about. But I'm not necessarily proposing that everybody goes out and starts touching kids more and hugging them and all that kind of stuff, because there's complexities related to that. If you're working with populations of young people who have had transgressive or abusive experiences of touch, then they may have ambivalence about touch and fears around touch. But even more so in terms of in current culture, we've really encountered a lot of anxiety about the touching between adults and children. This is in part due to increasing awareness over the past several decades about sexual abuse. But it's even been referred to as what's been called a moral panic, about touch related to, you know, adults touching children. Bimoral panic, this term is really looking at kind of an intense societal preoccupation with either an event, a phenomenon, a person, a group, that sort of thing. And the moral part is that it's seemed to be a threat to our values or our societal order. And the panic part is the perception of the degree of threat tends to be disproportionate. It tends to be exaggerated as compared to the actual threat. So we're seeing things like kids not being able to sit on Santa's lap or in research. And if you're interested in the moral panics around touch, one of the leading researchers on this is a researcher by the name of Heather Piper. And if you, again, were to do a search just looking at the name Heather Piper, you would find a lot of her publications about this. And they've done a lot of studies in education. That's been their key focus. And looking at things like teachers being afraid to put a plaster on a child's knee because they were worried that this contravened, prescriptions against touching. And in fact, some of their findings is about how touch has kind of completely gotten away from anything that's relaxed or instinctive or feeling natural to more becoming about kind of the self-conscious negative act that's really about protecting the organization or the individual against allegation or against misinterpretation rather than really about expressing care or meeting the needs of children. It's really become this fear-based thing. Again, another author about this, and the first that I could find that used the term moral panic in relation to touching between adults and children, is a teacher who is in Australia, and he wrote a book called Hands Off. And he wrote very movingly about his own experiences as a preschool teacher in the early 1980s, and you know, and how he had experienced the ability to touch kids, and then how that changed, and how he felt he had to accept what he called a stifling effect about being worried about the things he used to do to establish warm, trusting relationships with children because of this moral panic. And so it's difficult because people are living and working within real constraints about sometimes organizational policies of no touch or about unspoken, murky, fuzzy kind of expectations about whether or not to touch and how to touch and that sort of thing. And so it's not as clear-cut as we know touch is good for kids, so get out there and touch them. Not only is it not good for all kids in all circumstances, it is seen for many as a dangerous thing to do as a professional. And so it's an interesting and complicated area that's probably worthy of a 45-minute discussion. And I guess I'll leave it at that, other than just touch on the findings in my own study. When I went back and really delved into the data and analyzed what are people really saying anytime they were talking about anything to do with touch, I interviewed 41 staff and 37 kids. Lengthy interviews, sometimes as long as 3 hours with adults, and as long as 50 minutes with kids. And it's interesting if you look at what they were saying. Staff were talking about touch, and no member of staff said, "I'm afraid to touch kids. I'm afraid to give them a cuddle." No one said anything like that. It was much more subtle. But if you really listen to what they were saying, they used the word risk, or they talked about risk very strongly in relation to touch. Sometimes the risk of escalating a child further, but much more often the risk, again, of being seen as to be doing something abusive or pervy. Nobody used the word pervy, but you had to make sure other staff were present to witness it, and you had to make sure that it wasn't misperceived by a young person. And this communication of risk was much more dominant than other themes of the benefits or the importance or that sort of thing. And when kids were talking about touch, they were all likening it to expressions of aggression. Nobody should be able to touch us and that sort of thing. Now, that may have had to do with the fact that the interviews were all about physical restraint, and so that clearly would have colored it. Staff also talked about experiencing very aggressive touch from kids in terms of injuries, and both staff and kids talked a lot about injury. But one of the most interesting parts, and again, we may or may not choose to go here in the discussion, was the connection between physical restraint, touch, and catharsis. And both staff and young people talked about either witnessing young people or experiencing themselves using restraint as a way to be physically held through cathartic events, and whether intentional or unconscious or it just happened to be a byproduct of the restraint. And there's real concerns about that and how that may create a destructive dependency if it's not handled well. And I think there have been cases where this has happened. Staff touched on it in my own practice background. So, you know, it raises questions about kids who have experienced traumatic events and are trying to recover, and if we're kind of afraid to even give them a hug under certain circumstances, kids who really need kind of a more robust form of physical contact or physical holding to kind of get them through. And I certainly have experienced in my worst moments wanting to be physically held through difficult times, and yet we're kind of afraid of this, how then that might be translated into kind of legitimizing physical restraint over other forms of touching, which was one of the findings. So that's my effort to kind of do a brief kind of, I don't know, maybe 12 minutes that was on some of the points of touch that we can talk more deeply about if you want. How's that for a starter for Tim?
That's fantastic, Laura. Thank you so much for really, you know, succinctly putting so many points around touch and kind of contextualizing it and going through a few of the issues. And it's obviously something that an area that's of great interest to you, and that it's interesting that you see, you know, that it's not a case of both sides, but you know that it's not as simple as we maybe have in some areas where we perceive some areas in education where we say, well, the problem is the teachers ought to be doing something to sort out this problem. But I think the way you're talking, Laura, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're not putting any blame on teachers. You're not saying that teachers are deficient. You're recognising that there are reasons why teachers and other significant adults possibly don't use touch as much as they should, or as much as they may wish to.
Yes. Yeah, I think also, you know, sometimes we call it urban myth, and urban myths will evolve around you can't do this or you have to do it that way or that sort of thing. And if there aren't spaces to kind of reflectively discuss as a group, people will interpret it, kind of whatever they're picking up from the ether. I've also had a couple of students actually who've done some very small scale research as part of their dissertation into this subject, and it's interesting the number of staff who actually talk quite candidly about their own experiences of affecting their comfort or discomfort with touching kids. And so sometimes that interpretation of either organizational policy or organizational culture as to what's acceptable and what's not will be strongly colored by one's own level of comfort or discomfort with touch and their own experiences as a young person. And if we leave individuals just to struggle with this on their own, actually, then, so I think there's organizational levels of responsibility to kind of address not just this, but, you know, a lot of the more complex areas of practice, and yet, you know, with greater levels of policy imperatives kind of controlling what teachers do with their time, it seems, and same in residential childcare, it seems that the spaces for this kind of reflective discussion and kind of co-construction of meaning is being squeezed out by other what feels like busy work sometimes. So, yeah, certainly not blaming teachers. We also live in a culture. I mean, in Britain and the United States, both are kind of two of the least touchy cultures in the non-majority world or the developed countries. And so there's lots of layers to this. As it compared to some Mediterranean countries where it's very common for people to touch each other quite a lot more. So, yeah, it wouldn't serve kids in terms of discussing and reflecting on this just to kind of lay simple blame at the feet of any individual or even, you know, at any one level.
So, I mean, Laura, My background is not anywhere near yours or David's, because I've been a primary school teacher really for the last 20 years. And I think when I started teaching, my daughter had just been born, and I probably was a lot more touchy-feely than I would be now. But I mean, I think there's been a few things. There's been a sort of gradual increase in awareness of the negative, and children being more aware of the fact that touch can be negative, and that they have got the right not to be touched, sort of thing. I'm not in the classroom full time anymore, but by the end of the time I was in the classroom, I certainly wouldn't have really touched a child without a great deal of thought or something that needed immediate action, you know, maybe to catch somebody that was falling over, or, you know, stop somebody doing something. But 20 years before that, I think I would have been a lot happier, certainly even picking children up and things like that, I wouldn't do now.
I'm curious then, from your experience, and I do think gender's a factor here, and it was certainly in my research where men talked about being more self-conscious and feeling like women were more able to not just touch kids, but, you know, de-escalate situations and that sort of thing. But for your experience over, did you say 20 years?
Yeah, give or take.
Of
I think
teaching.
It's 1981 I've started teaching. So.
Okay, so on the one hand, you're more aware that children may not want to be touched, and so you think about it more, and I would consider that a positive. Overall, do you think more has been gained from your heightened awareness, or more has been lost? If there was some way to tally it, which qualitative, so it really can't be, but just in your gut.
I would have said, as a gut feeling, it's been a loss. I think especially as a male primary school teacher, there's been an awful lot of, and it may be a moral panic, but it's still sort of sitting there in the ether that you might be considered to be doing something wrong, and somebody may pick you up from it. And it might not lead to anything, you know, life changing, career threatening, or anything like that. But you just, it's probably not worth the grief.
Is that a conscious thing? Is that at a conscious level or less conscious level in terms of when you're actually in there working with kids?
I think it was conscious. I couldn't say when I started teaching, but I can remember early in my career working with infants quite a lot. And I mean, some kids just sometimes needed picked up and carried around, or somebody just, they weren't in a fit state to join in with the class, but they would quite happily and be, you know, quite happy sitting on your knee while you were taking a group or something like this. And I always felt that was reasonable. I mean, I in a similar situation now, I don't think I would do the same thing.
And yet we know that children at that age benefit greatly from affectionate touch. That it's a definitely needed part of child development, and we look at how many hours kids spend at that age in other forms of care other than their parents, and then you think about kids where there's struggles going on in the home and the parents may be less attuned to their kids' needs or that sort of thing, and how there was a time when good teachers might have been kind of filling in some gaps for kids, and now that's less safe for the adults involved, and I just wonder the cumulative impact developmentally, especially for kids who are struggling to begin with.
Well, I would think I don't know, but you know that, but I think it would have a negative effect actually on just on the general running of a class. It makes things more difficult. You need to be more aware and more considered. Sometimes when something could have been dealt with in a much more relaxed way. I don't know if it's even possible now then to keep it sort of with a natural feeling anymore, because there's a sort of layer of knowingness and things on.
Do you think kids pick up on that as well in terms of getting a sense when adults are less natural, less comfortable, or more self-conscious?
I don't know. I would have guessed yes. The other thing is, I think that over the last few years, children are much more aware of what they think of as their rights. Now, this doesn't necessarily relate to touching, but across the board, I don't want to do that becomes, it seems to be much more of a choice for children now than it used to be, and I don't know if that sticky situations seem to be maybe able to arise easier, although we probably deal with them better than overall than we did in the past.
Yeah, the whole rights paradigm, and I'm definitely in favour of increasing awareness of children as active agents in their world, as possessors of rights, but the rights as a dominant way of thinking about our relationships with one another is really about competing rights and whose rights trumps whose, and rights come from kind of a more adversarial kind of system of law, whereas teaching used to be a much more relational kind of vocation, and certainly residential child care practice as well as other human services, in terms of where there clearly are sometimes tensions between relationships, but it's more complex than whose rights trump whose, and the inherent kind of adversarial flavor sometimes that creeps into that. And so while I would never want to kind of dismiss children's rights, I think that a more complex reading of children's rights as well as a more relational orientation is probably more likely going to not only meet kids' needs but be more respectful of them as agents who are possessing of rights and able to influence their environments and all that kind of stuff. But in some ways, when it's simplistically thought about and simplistically implemented, it actually is counterproductive for all involved, not just for kids.
Well, I was thinking more, I think David's going to say something in a minute, but more the caricature, I know my rights reaction to everything, I think has crept in to an awful lot of areas. You just need to look at the number of people that have been sued all over the place, and that sort of spills into the classroom.
It's all fear-based, isn't it?
I'd just like, just at this point, like to remind listeners that they can get in touch with Laura over the last 20 minutes or so of tonight's show on Touch. You can email the show at edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, and if you're on Twitter, you can put your question or comment for Laura there, and just include the hashtag edutalk, and we'll pick that up. Laura, as I said at the start of the show, we've had some questions come in earlier on today. We've also had a couple of questions online since the start of the show. What I thought might be best, because you haven't seen any of these questions, I'm assuming you haven't, unless you've been trolling the web beforehand, because they are out there somewhere. what I'll maybe do then is just offer you sort of a couple of questions at a time, and you can answer both, or one, or neither. The first couple of questions, hopefully they kind of link together. It's just around moral panic. When are you able to kind of identify, whether in Western society or North America or Europe or Scotland, when touch seemingly became immoral within care and education settings? Just another question, as I said, to give the option, what are the implications for child development of touch deprivation?
Okay. As tracking back in my research, which I'm not sure that I didn't miss anything, was the Australian teacher, I'm bad with names, Richard T. Johnson, used the term moral panic about touch in 2000. Certainly Adrian Ward, who's probably one of the most published about residential childcare, did write about touch in either 1998 or 1999, and he wrote a chapter about no touching, can we really go on this way or whatever. So it started coming into the literature in the mid to late 90s. The first time I saw it being called a moral panic, and was in 2000. And I think it's even got stronger since then. That Piper, I told you about, she's done some research with other people. She did a very large piece of research with Ian Stronach, and they looked at policies across quite a very large number of educational establishments, and some of the ridiculous things that were in their policies about touch, of something as prescriptive as not putting barrettes in children's hair or not touching children's genitals. And it's like, okay, if you have to be, or not touching children's genitals in a way that arouses them. And they rightly ask the question, if people have to be told this, you know, in a policy, are these people that really need to be employed? And so I guess, again, that reveals kind of the increasing moral panic. Having said that, Celsus did a seminar with unit managers, and one of the areas of discussion was touch. And I found it really heartening that several of the unit managers are like, we've been there and we're coming back from that, and they didn't say they're getting brave, but essentially, you know, we're taking risks with that, and we're getting over it, you know. And so I wonder if the pendulum is starting to begin to swing the other way in some pockets where people are saying this is crazy. And I guess one of the reasons it's crazy, which shifts me to the second question. So I'm not sure exactly when it was identified as a moral panic, certainly related to education and child care. The first I saw was published anyway, was in 2000. It was around as early as the early to mid-90s for me when I was in practice, and I've written about this. I guess the links might go up with the podcast or with however you do the recording of this. But I've written about touch, both the positives and the moral panic, and I've also written about my own experiences of practice related to touch. And I worked in a place where there's a lot of fear around touch and side hugs only and no horseplay and all this kind of stuff. And that was 92. So that was in Colorado, and we were already uptight about touch back in 92. I hear people who've been in the field much longer talking about in the 70s or early 80s feeling much more natural about touch. So I'm not exactly sure. And it probably varied from place to place when this phenomenon kind of started to sweep, where people became really uptight. I would link it probably to revelations of sexual abuse. And I think that's where a lot of the panic comes from, is being seen to be sexually inappropriate with kids, and touch being obviously the most powerful medium through which both positive things can be expressed as well as very damaging things can be done to children. So I guess that would be my guess. In terms of the effects of touch deprivation, yeah, there's some interesting stuff on that. Let me take a look at my notes here. I've got certainly with children it can cause sleep deprivation, and there have been studies about children who've been separated from their parents, and you know, parents being in hospital, and so a lot less touch, and again increases in cortisol. Certainly in mammals, and they've done a lot more studies on touch deprivation with mammals. Because that was seen as more ethically sound. I don't think we'd want to do that with children, and I have ambivalence about doing that to rhesus monkeys as well. But, you know, definitely finding failure to thrive, and we know from Romanian orphanages of children who not only had failure to thrive but even died, even though they were getting adequate nutrition and basic care. And that's really extreme forms. The less extreme forms that are probably more relevant to our discussion in terms of the professionalism, maybe listening, we have more to do with development of sense of esteem and efficacy, and the sleep deprivation I mentioned. I'm looking for my notes to do with, oh yeah, suppression of the immune system is another strong finding in terms of touch deprivation in the developing human beings. And I would add to that, you know, it's compounded by other factors, and so it's really hard to separate it out. But if a child is experiencing, for instance, trauma or loss and separation and touch deprivation, it's really hard to weave out. But what seems really clear is that the need for affectionate or reassuring touch is all the greater for children who have compounding factors. And yet sometimes they're the ones who get the least amount of touch because of the, you know, fear, the culture of fear, or the moral panic related to touch.
So earlier, Laura, did I pick pick you up right, you were suggesting that sometimes it almost sounded like either staff or pupils were engineering the restraint or getting themselves into these situations because there was a sort of need for touch, and they couldn't have a sort of gentle touch. Is that?
Yeah, nothing quite that.
That's too strong.
Obvious, yeah. but what kids were saying was, some kids were saying, like, there's a very poignant quote from a young woman who by the end of the interview told me she hadn't been restrained in over a year. So some of these questions about developing dependencies, I don't think is always the case, but she did talk about, you know, sometimes you just need to be held. She said something along these lines, and earlier in the interview, in all the interviews, I kind of had asked the respondent about, you know, whether they thought physical restraint was ever an okay or acceptable thing, and if they said yes, I'd say under what circumstances, and almost everybody was pretty unanimous about, you know, in imminent danger, risk of harm, you know, in whatever words that they said. So I said, sometimes you just need to be held, and I said, so, like, not imminent danger or something. I probably reflected her own words back to her, and she said, well, yeah, because you have to go mad in order for them to hold you. And she wasn't the only one who spoke about this. Interestingly, it was older girls who were more candid and reflective, and developmentally that kind of makes sense, about having had experiences of using restraint to let things out. Boys talked about it in terms of anger. Girls talked about it in terms of needing to be held or needing to cry, which, again, isn't surprising but is interesting. Kids talked about seeing other kids who they thought were maybe orchestrating restraints on purpose. And then some kids didn't talk about getting restrained on purpose but talked about how much better they felt after restraint because they let it all out, kind of thing. And staff also kind of talked about this, although they were reticent about it. So they start to say, I know this doesn't sound PC, or you may not believe this, but you know, some kids kind of look like they're building up to it or even doing it on purpose or that sort of thing. And you just kind of want to go up and give them a hug. One woman, I've got more quotes than I'm able to put in the publications, actually. People really said very rich, poignant things in these interviews. And one woman said, you know, you just want to give them a hug, but they don't know how to let you or accept that from you. And sometimes they just need to have a physical fight first before, you know. And this was a minority. They weren't talking about all their experiences of restraint, but it was a significant minority, either of kids who talked about it or staff talking about a few kids that they had worked with. So I really don't want to misrepresent this as being kind of across the board or on a grander scale, but these kids matter, you know, and so I don't think anybody's going, well, I really can't give you a hug, I'm going to have to, you know, do this coercive kind of violent process with you instead. No. But it's more subtle than that. But yeah, actually, on some level, yeah.
I wasn't actually a conscious level more than an unconscious level.
Yeah.
A wee question that's come up on the Twitter feed, Laura, is probably slightly more personal to you. It's what's your most prominent memory of touch working with kids? Now, I'm presuming that means when you were working with kids rather than
How I would interpret it, too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. The first thing that I remember when you just asked that was given, I had worked in the place that I talked to you about that in the early 90s where they were very prescriptive about touch. And then I moved to Scotland in 99 and started working in a residential child care there. And the first thing that came to mind when you asked that question was giving this little 12-year-old boy who was just this lovely little fireball of a kid. And he had a very low voice for being, he was small for his age and stocky and bright red flaming hair that went with his temper. But I remember giving him a lot of what we call here Cody backs, or the piggyback rides, up from the yard into the unit, and just the joy that gave both of us, actually. I don't know if that's the most prominent memory, but that's one of them. Another one is, and I've written about this one, actually. A young man from my unit, he went to the children's panel, and he'd been doing so well, and he was really somewhat of a bystander in quite a serious incident with older young people. So we certainly weren't expecting the decision, which was to put him in secure. So the head of care and I drove out to the secure unit that night with all his belongings, and he was not a very demonstrative kid, verbally or touch-wise. And we got on fine, you know, I guess, but he was pretty self-contained into himself. And so at the end of our very short visit, I remember not thinking about it and just hugging him. And the car on the way back from the secure unit, I was wondering about how that was for the young person, like whether that was just my need to hug him because I was so upset at losing him from our unit, and how he felt about it. And then my boss witnessing this, and even though there wasn't this uptight culture about touch, I still wasn't sure. It's interesting, the residue stays with you from previous experiences. And it's interesting, my head of care said, before I even had the chance to raise it or ask what he thought, he said, do you know, he really clung on to you for dear life, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so it was actually reassuring, because I was just so caught up in the emotion of what had happened to this kid that I didn't think about it, and I didn't reflect on whether this would be okay with the kid or not. And mm-hmm. we should reflect, but we should also be spontaneous sometimes. But that was a bit reassuring and a relief, actually. There was a time, probably when I first started working in the field, that I wouldn't have even thought about it after the fact, let alone been relieved that somebody had kind of confirmed that it was okay. So those are the two that come to mind. It's probably because I've written about both of them.
Laura, we're coming to the end of tonight's show, and again, if anybody would like to get in touch, now's the time, by email or on Twitter. You've spoken about this earlier on tonight, around policies, so maybe explore it slightly more. Ultimately, Laura, do you think that organisations working with children need to have policies on touch? And if a policy is very much around workers being hands-off with children, i.e. no touch, do you think that practitioners, you know, street level workers should be challenging such policies, and if so, how might they go about that?
Okay, so there's three parts to that question. The first part to do with policy, that big study that I mentioned by Piper and Stranach, it's published in a book called Don't Touch, and one of their aims in doing this big study was to be able to offer the field something about this question of how, you know, being able to offer guidance about writing a policy. And interestingly, what they concluded after this very big, deep piece of research was that policies actually are counterproductive, because they add to the whole static or anxiety or that sort of thing. And I'm not sure if I totally agree or not. What I do know is that CELSIS does have a view to create some sort of guidance, whether it won't be a policy and it won't necessarily be encouraging units or special schools or whatever to develop a hard and fast policy, but more to look at space, more to look at the kinds of things people should reflect on in terms of how that should inform their practice related to touch, and the kinds of supports for staff and supervisors and managers to make sure that they have good practice related to touch in terms of spaces where people reflect together and challenge each other, and where even kids can speak about this openly. So I guess I'm kind of ambivalent about the whole notion of policy. The idea of a complete no-touch policy, I think, is more protective of adults and protective of organizations than it is protective of children. And so at the very least, it shouldn't be dressed up as child protection, because I don't think it is. And it depends on the purpose of the organization and the primary task. Certainly, if it's an organization that is caring for children, especially if caring for children in a semi-full-time basis, then I think definitely staff to challenge it. But even in terms of like a classroom setting, I think that kind of a mute acceptance of no-touch policies may be soul-crushing for staff and may, as you said earlier, have more losses for the not only the smooth functioning of the classroom, but the level of warmth and emotional safety that children feel. And we know that those things affect the level of learning and more general development that they're going to have. So, yes, how they challenge that. I guess that's sometimes why I mention authors or mention places to Google or use search engines. It's because I think information is one of your best ammunitions, and maybe I shouldn't use the violent metaphor, but like a war metaphor, but your best form of persuasion, especially in this day and age when there's so much purchase on evidence base. Well, there's an increasingly strong evidence base that this isn't good for kids, and it, in the final analysis, isn't probably all that protective of staff, because the stronger your relationships with kids are, the less likely, I was only ever accused of anything by a kid on one occasion in all the years that I was in practice. And I was involved in restraints, and I worked with kids who got really angry at me for having to set limits in ways that they didn't want me to. And he retracted within a couple of hours and talked, at length with me about what that had been about. Now, in some respects, I was lucky, but I do think that the stronger and healthier your relationships are with each other as staff and with kids, that does have a positive impact on the likelihood of accusation. It's not a direct relationship. It's not, and I naively used to think when I was early in practice, if you just have good relationships with kids, then you'll never be accused of anything. Certainly not that simple, but it does have a positive effect. So how you challenge your employer is I think you bring forth evidence and you ask to discuss it in meetings and other forums.
I just wonder, Laura, if there's parallels with moral panic. I don't know if that's too strong a phrase around taking young people who are not your own children outdoors into maybe the countryside where there might be some kind of risk or some kind of setting. And we all know certainly that within mainstream education and maybe to an extent urban myth, but all the form filling that has to go through and professionals saying it's not worth all the effort and it takes the fun out, such like. And then there's been headlines in some of the papers about accidents that have actually happened, and the big debate about whether these things will happen and children will learn from it, and it's important to have some kind of risk. But I'm wondering, you said about 15 minutes ago about the tide might be turning back towards touch or safe levels of touch, safe kinds of touch or whatever, or some extent that might be coming back and seen as acceptable, whether that's circumventing local policies or not. Because we had it was last year or maybe 2 years ago now, publication Go Outdoors, which...
Yeah, I just looked that up because I think you're bang on. Yeah, uh-huh. So Cirque made that publication, Go Outdoors, Guidance and Good Practice on Encouraging Outdoor Activities. And it was aimed at addressing a fear culture or a risk-averse culture. And I think both the touch, the fear of touch and the fear of taking kids outdoors or doing activities with them are both based in this risk-averse culture, and that whatever we do in Celsus related to a guidance on touch is going to be a similar agenda as the Go Outdoors to try to curb the risk-averse, because really we should be assessing kids more on more than just minimizing risk. We should be assessing what kids need in order to flourish, to grow, to develop, to heal. Part of that does involve minimizing risk, but actually part of development involves having risks. And, that discussion we had earlier about children's rights, well, children have a right to be able to break their arm as part of growing up, just like kids in normal families break their arm fallen out of a tree or whatever, and yet we wrap them in cotton wool again, not only and often not at all for their benefit, but to protect ourselves. And so, yeah, I think the parallel is rooted in risk aversion and less about risk to the child and more about risk to the organization, whether organizations would be aware of that or willing to reflect on that or admit to that or not. I think that that has shifted, and that's not happening just in, say, residential or education. That's a much wider phenomenon happening, you know, in the whole we don't have time to go into managerialism and the impact that has had, but that's a key factor as well.
Certainly the Go Outdoors document has been incredibly helpful to me in curriculum planning the last few years. I mean, it's worth anybody listening to have a look at. I know it's kind of aimed at children's homes and residential schools and such like, but it really just kind of boils everything down to a few key questions that you just go through, either written down or just in discussions with other staff and young people, and that's a simple but effective process that I find that I'm now able to go through as you're planning an outdoors experience or something with some risk. So certainly a document I would recommend to anybody working with young people to check out. And John might want to come in, and I know we're running out of time. I've just got one more question and just a brief answer, Laura, but you're somebody that is very well read, and you've conducted research in this area, and it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you. And no doubt, you know, you're coming from a stance. I mean, you're somebody with a CYC background, and maybe something just to maybe explain that kind of paradigm and that kind of area of social research and working with children that you kind of come from. You know, and you've got clear opinions based on your experience and your research. Can I ask you about horseplay? Where do you stand on that within organisations, where, you know, whether it's, I don't know if there's a gender issue there as well, or it's something that I'm interested in. If you can talk in kind of general terms rather than maybe specific to residential or such.
Yeah, I've written specifically about it, and it'll be in one of the links that I sent to you that will go up. But I think, you know, horseplay is a difficult one. Because I think sometimes inappropriate things happen in horseplay, less often sexual, more often about dominance and I can hurt you kind of stuff, both kids to staff and staff to kids, and toy fighting being kind of the worst offender of that. And yet I think that was one of the primary vehicles that there was really important communication going on, and even expression of affection and closeness and play and the importance of play. And so I guess my feeling is this. I think any form of touch that has the potential, the negative potential, and horseplay does have quite a big negative potential as well, just needs to be dealt with rather than eliminated, you know, in terms of talking openly about what's going on within horseplay. And certainly in my unit, the way I dealt with it was play shouldn't hurt, and if you're hurting kids on purpose, then, you know, that falls under abuse. So, you know, and getting the kids as well to kind of realize play shouldn't hurt when they were playing with me. And so, yeah, I worked in a place where it was banned outright, and I'm not sure that's the answer. I think kids need to learn how to play and how to play physically and that sort of thing. But I think we should be very deliberate and attentive to the processes that are going on, and not just, oh, it's just horseplay and sort of anything goes within certain bounds. We need to reflect on what's going on for that kid, what does that kid need, what's going on in your dynamic with him or her, and not just help by individuals trying to make sense of that. I think a team approach, whether it's residential or, I'm not sure about horseplay in the classroom, but, you know, I think it needs to be a reflective part of practice, just like other parts of practice.
Well, Laura, I think we're slightly over time as usual, but I think that's down to the content, which has been great. Just a last comment. One of the things David just commented, this comparison with risk assessment for going outdoors or for risky activities, there seems to be a real parallel, and that sort of goes back and forward about over the years, I suppose, how much risk you can take. But I think maybe the important thing that we're coming to in that and in perhaps in the touch thing, is that the idea of reflection,
which
I certainly think newer practitioners, educational practitioners and myself are much more willing to do or trained to do, and becomes maybe the solution rather than laying down the rules that you were a bit worried about.
Yeah, because we can't do paint by numbers and working with kids and developing relationships with them. There's no formula of do this and don't do that. And you're right, reflection. And I'll make a very quick pitch for containment theory, which is what I've written about a lot in relation to this in the publication on touch, which isn't the normal term containment of warehousing kids. It's more about creating environments that enable both kids and staff to contain anxiety such that they can think clearly and reflect. And so we need to create environments that staff can reflect, that they can think clearly, because with all the fear and risk aversion, it actually interferes with the ability to have useful reflection that informs practice. And so there's not space or time to go into what's involved in that, but I do think that's a really important component of supporting people to reflect, is creating environments that manage all that anxiety and deal with all that anxiety in a way that what I would call is containing, so that they can reflect. But yeah, I think it comes down to reflection, well spotted.
So, yeah, thank you very much, Laura. I mean, certainly from my point of view, which is coming from a different place in education, I find that really valuable to think about, and I'm sure it would cut right across all sorts of educators. So
yeah, well, thanks for letting me talk about it. I'm always delighted to be able to talk about this subject.
It's great to hear folk do it. And if you enjoyed the show, you've another question, you can always folk listening can ping on Twitter. Laura is, I think you're at Laura Steckley.
Good question. Let me look.
Yeah, I think you are.
There's not many Steckleys out there,
no,
so yeah, at Laura Steckley.
It's a good game. And we didn't, unfortunately, have time to talk about letterboxing, so I'll leave that as a...
Oh, no worries.
When people can
another
follow
time.
Up.
I'm happy to come back. I was almost as enthusiastic about that.
Well, people can follow that up if they see your Twitter profile, because there's a link to letterboxing.
Hi.
So I'll leave that as a wee teaser. The other teaser for folk listening out there is next week we've got Louise Jones, who is ICT Curriculum Liaison Officer for Highland Council, and she's going to talk about social networking guidance for professionals. And I think that will fit or dovetail quite nicely with tonight's.
Yeah.
It's not about...
Sticky issues there too.
Yeah, there's some nice complexities and plenty of room, we hope, for reflection. So, once again, thanks very much to Laura. And good night, folks.
Thank you.